We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
There's going to be some players who decide they don't want to play this year. I mean, that's just one of the realities of this, and if that's the case, that's fine. They're adults. They have free will. They can do whatever they want to do. But hopefully enough of them will come back so we can actually have a competitive season in whatever form it takes. I, for one, am looking forward to it, and I'm hoping that we see a resolution sooner rather than later.
The familiar voice of Steve Stone talking to Mully and Haw. Yeah, maybe players who maybe just don't want to play, that don't want to take the risk. Let's find out what's going on with baseball's the fits and starts of these efforts to find some roadmap to bringing the game back. Evan Drellich is the Athletics national MLB writer. He's on Twitter at Evan Drellich. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Evan, how are you doing?
Dan, good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It got a little confusing as I'm reading and trying to understand what's been happening over the last couple of days, because it sounded like there was a formal proposal that already had been given from the owners to the Players Association after their conference call. But your colleague, Ken Rosenthal, was reporting that, yeah, they've got an 80-page document. They haven't shared it yet. What strategy is this on the part of Rob Manfred? And do you think they're actively trying to make the players look intransigent or reluctant?
Well, first, we can establish what's going on. So they talked digitally, I think it was over Zoom yesterday, for the first time about MLB's proposed vision. Inside of that proposed vision, you've got many different things. You've got health, safety, and then there's the economics element. MLB at some point here is going to propose to the union that the players take further reductions in salary. What MLB wants to do, but the union probably will directly say no to once that proposal is given, is put in a revenue sharing system. On the first day of the meetings, they did talk economics, but they didn't get that firm economics proposal. Now, the 80-page thing you're referring to, That's the health protocols. That's MLB's list of suggestions, and the union will have plenty of input into that. So there's stages to this here. There was some thought that on day one, the economics could be more firmly brought up. It didn't end up being the case. Maybe it's that they want to work out the health issues first and then leave the money to the end. And to your point about making the players look intransigent, if you leave the money to the end, if you get to a point where the only thing that is standing between baseball returning in 2020, you know, from kind of a policy point, is money and working out the money, you're going to see those battle lines drawn where both sides are going to be trying to paint the other as the bad guy.
I'm concerned from the player's perspective. I understand that there could be a slippery slope here of something that would appear temporary not being so, much like the airlines charged fuel surcharges and then just made those permanent regardless of, you know, the actual price of fuel, that we get mission creep. And should the owners successfully say, well, unprecedented times and all of this effect and the headwinds on the business, and then just do different versions of that ongoing. Even when the initial surge of the pandemic fades, they could say, well, this has been nearly a permanent effect on our business that's never going to be the same. Therefore, we need to keep these things in place to help mitigate our losses or the change in our economic modeling. I think the players going to have to be really smart in making sure that they don't agree to something open-ended where the owners can just kind of keep twisting them on it.
Correct. And they're certainly thinking that way when it comes to this idea of revenue sharing, because the players in their revenue sharing plan see the likes of a salary cap, even if it doesn't function exactly like a salary cap. MLB doesn't think the revenue sharing plan should be considered a salary cap. The semantics don't really matter. If the union looks at it and says this is too close to it, even if it's not identical, we're rejecting it. The thing they have to get over here, it's not so much the mechanism of the money, salary cap, revenue sharing, whatever. It's do the players need to take a further reduction in money? Right now the players say no. The league obviously says yes. The league says if we play regular season games, we will lose money. And that doesn't include the postseason necessarily. And it's a question of whether you get to the postseason. Are you able to play enough games? Because the postseason is where all the big TV money lies, or at least a lot of it. So one of the next steps here might be the union saying to the league, give us more of your financial information. Prove your peril if we're going to give you back more money. Because in March, the players agreed to prorate their salaries. So there's already been a pay cut, but the league wants further pay cut because there won't be fans in the stadiums at all, or at least largely.
Talking with Evan Drellich on Sports 670 The Score, and I'd love to see what is in the 80-page document and how they have consulted with experts on what matters here, because we keep focusing on the game itself. We keep focusing on the spitting or the licking of fingers and touching the ball, the proximity of a runner at first and the first baseman or umpire and catcher, when really, with every day that goes by, we learn more about the exposure, the danger of transmission being much more on the bus or in the clubhouse together. The times they spend around each other matter much more. In the hotels, how that's all going to be arranged. This it reminds me, Evan, of what Joe Maddon, every once a year, he would do what he called Legion Week. And it was a home series in which he told the guys, don't show up to the clubhouse too early. Just show up and play. Just pull up, you know, get out of your car or ride your bike over with your spikes on, just like you're playing Legion ball, and let's go. I'm thinking you're not going to have the hanging around the cages, the clubhouse, and all the stuff if they're doing it intelligently. It may just be that guys have to get ready at home, come right to the game, and get out there and play if they're going to actually be as safe as they can possibly be.
It's a good point, and right now it's just a little too early to say what's in that document. Boy, I'd love it if they would send it right to me, but you know, we don't know exactly yet what they're thinking. But the union has independent health experts. The league has been consulting with health experts too. They talk to the government. There's going to be a lot of voices in the mix here, and there's got to be a lot of contingency planning. It's not really just one plan. It's this is what we'd like to do, and then if something goes wrong in the XYZ 3,800 ways something could go wrong, what do we do? Where do we relocate a team to if we need to? What do we do if somebody gets sick or multiple people get sick? Do you take a team out of commission? Does the rest of the sport keep going? You can make an almost infinite list of questions that exist right now on those health matters, which I guess is why, indeed, it's 80 pages.
I wonder what happens, too, to the service time issues for a conscientious objector. That if someone says, look, my wife has an underlying condition that would make her predisposed to a deleterious response to COVID, I'm not going to play for that reason. Do they say, well, sorry, you're still no closer to free agency? I mean, I wonder how fair they're going to be and how much this stuff gets horse traded as they negotiate.
It's going to be a focus for the union, and I think for both sides. There's no scenario where MLB could collar somebody and say, you get out there and play. So logically, if somebody doesn't want to play, They're not going to be forced to be, but then it becomes what you're talking about. Well, what does that player receive if they were due a lot of money or if they would have gotten service time? How should that be handled? They're going to address all that, and I think the union will put that high on its priority list because you do need guys to be comfortable taking the risk, and you do have guys with underlying medical conditions. Ken Rosenthal at The Athletic talked to a couple, I think it was yesterday, first story that's online now. So it's you're getting to a topic that's already on the forefront of their minds.
We've been looking at the and comparing and contrasting the responses of the relative leagues and the issues from the relative leagues as they all share information with each other around the globe, even, and trying to figure out what constitute proper best practices. Yet it is starkly different how the NBA's players' relationship with their commissioner, that the union and the league, there's clearly a degree of trust that is absent in baseball. And maybe it's because Rob Manfred has been the bulldog, the actual labor negotiator in some of these collective bargaining agreements and has been the adverse party. But what can baseball do at this moment as they're all, you know, fighting for their own rights and their own pocketbooks here to repair what appears to be a damaged level of trust?
Well, I don't want to say there's too much trust to repair in this moment, but you're not going to go through this negotiation and have both sides all of a sudden singing kumbaya. There's just too much recent history, if not longer term history, of contentiousness on issues of service time, tanking, some of the smaller market teams not spending money with revenue sharing, like Pirates. Go down the list. There are a lot of reasons for the players to be skeptical of the league, and maybe to some degree vice versa. They know that there's going to be already is immense pressure to get back out on the field. So they're just going to have to work through it. And so if you want to have kind of the optimistic bent here, if they can get through this under this amount of pressure, maybe that positions them a little bit better for the next round of collective bargaining, because after the 21 season, the CBA was up, is up. And that's going to be the next time they do this. So we're kind of getting, you know, a pseudo work stoppage situation a year and a half early.
You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, that this is sort of a testing ground, that you're right. If they could look at each other and say, if we got through this, if we emerged from this, that maybe we'll be in a little better position to start talking about things when a rising tide of better global health is gonna lift all the ships economically at that point, which has to be what they're betting on.
You would think, but I don't know that they're necessarily, maybe they've had this thought themselves that, you know, every negotiation leads into another. The MLB wanted to do 10 rounds with the draft this year, but that came with other concessions. The union felt like that was double dipping and on partly on a principle of negotiations. So they said, no, you know, this is not how we're going to conduct a negotiation. The landscape next year and after the 21 season could be vastly different, even if they get through this. And I do think they will find a way to get through the economics of this. One side could end up feeling very burnt here, potentially. And you don't always know the outcome of a deal right away, and particularly when there is so much uncertainty about how many fans can you let in, what will the revenues in the sport be. So one side or the other could be smarting from whatever they end up working out this year, and then that's going to set a sour taste going into 21. So, you can take the optimistic view. You can see the potential downside here. All I know is right now they got to focus on this.
And I know as long as we get a universal DH out of this here and after, I'm going to be a much happier baseball fan because it's too overdue.
You know, I grew up a National League fan, but in this instance, it makes sense because you're going to have a shortened spring training. You're going to have shortened rosters. There's probably going to be no minor league season. You really can't have a pitcher go down with a hammy going into second base in a season like this. It's just it's not the right time to lose somebody where you feel like it's needless.
I just think watching a pitcher hit's one of the dumbest things in sports, and it is a complete just vestigial aspect of sports that's needed to go away for a long time, regardless of injury risk. It's just dumb. Evan, we really appreciate you joining us, and thanks for the information. Continued good health to you.
Thanks, Dan.
That is Evan Drellich of The Athletic on Sports Radio 670. Let's talk a little Last Dance coming up next with someone you have seen, one of the really smart people who has been interviewed and weighs in at various stages of The Last Dance, Dr. Todd Boyd, the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture, Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. Or maybe you just refer to him by his nickname, the Notorious PhD. We'll talk a little Last Dance with him next on The Score.
Hey, what's up? Danny Parkins here, and if you're a fan of the 90s Bulls or just a fan of Chicago sports history, you've been watching ESPN's The Last Dance. Sunday night at 10, directly after the final episode, join me for a special Last Dance post-game show. I've been reliving my childhood through the eyes of an adult. I've absolutely loved it, even while pointing out this isn't a perfect documentation of history, but that's okay. It's been wildly entertaining. The Last Dance post-game show, Sunday night at 10, with me, Danny Parkins, right here on Sports Radio 670 The Score, official radio home of the Bulls, a Radio.com Sports Station.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
All the world's a stage when your name is Michael Jordan. So the spotlight that shines brightly on your triumphs also burns intensely on your mistakes. On Sunday in Orlando, Jordan had more than a bit part during the closing scene in Game 1, fourth quarter. Bulls up 91-90, 22 seconds to go. So the Bulls up one. Michael's got the ball in his hands. Not any longer. Kenny, to the former Bull, Horace Grant, Magic up by one.
When Michael came back from playing baseball and Nick Anderson stole his rock, the reason that stood out, you hadn't seen anybody take Michael's rock in a long time. It's like watching Muhammad Ali in the second half of his career when someone lands a punch on him. It's like, whoa, you mean you can hit this guy?
Jordan still had a chance to deliver one of his patented buzzer beaters, but instead he threw it away.
He dropped it out of bounds.
This just in, Michael Jordan is human. In crunch time, gives up the steal, throws the ball away, Bulls lose.
Intense stuff from The Last Dance, and the voice you heard in there, one of them, was that of Dr. Todd Boyd, who is joining us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. I got to take a deep breath before I give the actual job description here. Dr. Boyd is the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture, Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. I feel like I should keep going. The Master of Disaster, the King of Sting. He is with us on The Score. Hello, Dr. Boyd. How are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I want to engage maybe a little meta-criticism before we talk about some of the nuts and bolts of what we're actually seeing. Millions of people are watching this documentary because of what's going on right now. This is a shared communal sports experience that was completely unexpected with the attention that it's been garnering. What's the effect of that? What do you think, watching it now, having been a part of making it and now watching it, what matters about how this documentary is being consumed?
That's a very good question, and I've thought about that a lot. It reminds me of, when I was growing up, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And, basically they're three things on television. I mean, you'd have some local channels depending on where you live, but there's three major networks. And whatever was going down was going to happen on one of those three networks. And so even if you were watching one of the other two and one was sort of at the center of the conversation, everybody was familiar with it. It's not the way we consume media now. I mean, social media, multiple channels available for people to watch. People have whatever that they're doing in their own lives. And so to have a situation where it seems like a huge percentage of the population, or at least it feels that way, has been watching this and, commenting on it and posting photos and memes, it feels like a communal experience, of course, specific to the moment we're living through. So that part of it's, I think, excellent. On the other hand, because of the circumstances we're living through right now, at least in California, it may be different in other places, but, you know, lockdown over the country, you can't really go out in the public and talk about what you've seen. So everybody's watching it and everybody's experiencing it, but then the sort of aftermath of it takes place on social media, but you can't really go out in the public and engage it afterwards the way you can while you're watching it.
It's seeing all of this juxtaposed with the modern NBA and what it's become and how the nature of NBA stars has changed in large part due to the interactiveness, interconnectedness of social media and understanding a little bit that their role as citizens is something more important to some of these stars. What do we now know about Jordan, perhaps with some of the new context, now that we can see this and compare it to what we are seeing in sort of the postmodern NBA? Are there any new conclusions to be drawn about all of these things that happened so long ago?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about it in that way, Jordan was pre-social media. You know, if we stop talking about Jordan after 98 or even, you know, when he came back and played for Washington, you're still early 2000s, and that's a different story. But, you know, what we're looking at in The Last Dance, you know, all this existed before social media. I mean, the Internet was brand new. If you think about, you know, players who have come after Michael to, you know, perhaps sit in that same seat, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, these are athletes. Kobe in the second half of his career for sure was a figure very visible in social media, and LeBron's, you know, entire career, it seems like, has grown up around, you know, the Internet, social media, things like that. So Michael is a superstar from a different era. It's hard to believe, but that was, you know, if you go to 98, 22 years ago. I think, you know, when you look at Michael and all those stories about, you know, things he did in practice and, you know, I mean, I knew all these things because, you know, this is part of what I do, but the public didn't know. And so I think now, because of social media, people just know a lot more about athletes because athletes are able to, you know, dictate their own narrative through social media. Michael's a guy who was a superstar at a time when the narrative was being filtered through, you know, mainstream media. And so it's different because now I think people have a lot more connection to their superstars. For a lot of people, what they're seeing in this documentary was unknown. And I think that's why looking back at it, it's really informing a lot of people. If we were to look at a contemporary superstar, somebody like LeBron, he's more visible in social media on a regular basis, it probably wouldn't seem as revealing because a lot of this information would already be out there.
So many things happened concurrently with Jordan's rise in sports, and perhaps the most important was the acceleration of the evolution of hip-hop culture. And I'm 50 years old. I went to college in 1987, not really having heard much hip-hop music. I just wasn't into it. I wasn't exposed to it at that time. And meeting people in college, especially my friends from New York, who said, because I had heard of Run DMC, and then I started listening to it, I'm like, all right, something's going on here. And that leads into the deep dive into the New York stuff and Eric B. and Rakim and Big Daddy Kane and then Public Enemy. And I actually would share a story that actually when Do the Right Thing came out in 89, at the theater where I was in the Chicago suburbs, when I went to see it right when it came out, two rows in front of me, I realized at the end of the movie was Craig Hodges, who was sitting there actually watching that movie. And the explosion and the watching it all unfold in front of us. Was Jordan ever actively a part of that? Because the essence of it and some of what's significant about hip-hop culture always seemed to be something Jordan kept at arm's length even while he was selling shoes.
Well, I think if we look at Jordan in terms of the period when he came into the culture, the mid-1980s, you know, 84 draft, you know, the Air Jordan sneakers are very much a part of hip-hop culture, but that is something that would evolve and connect over time. I always like to point to the fact that, you know, when Michael went to the All-Star game in 85 wearing his Air Jordans and, you know, an entire sort of Air Jordan fit, as they say, a lot of people didn't like this. He's also, you know, he has gold chains on. And these were the things at the time that people associated with hip-hop culture, which was itself, as you point out, you know, in its really early stages, especially outside of New York. But, you know, I mean, Michael's a year older than I am. I was into hip-hop from day one, but I might have been a bit more enthusiastic than some of the other people my age. Over time, this would grow. I think when people think of, say, basketball and hip-hop culture, they think of the Fab Five, which is, you know, from the early 90s, certainly influenced by Michael. I think it's just the point that Michael came along. It was real early in that basketball-hip-hop connection, and ultimately the manifestation of that link would be Allen Iverson. And so, you know, in that famous play when Iverson, you know, crosses Jordan over much later in Jordan's career, around the time that the Last Dance is set, Iverson became the symbol and the focus of that connection. Jordan is a bit early in the process. There are some hip-hop elements, and I think it's been cool to use hip-hop music as a way of scoring this documentary, but Michael's a little early in the process, and I think just a few years' age difference would mean that by the time he gets to the, you know, near the end of the second retirement, he's a few years older than the people who are being associated with hip-hop, Shaquille O'Neal, you know, I mentioned Chris Webber and the Fab Five. So there's maybe some years difference, and Michael's at the front end of that. And then, you know, Iverson, of course, is even younger, and so going forward, you have a lot of guys coming into the NBA straight out of high school starting in 1995, so the league gets to be younger, especially fast, and by this time, I think Michael has moved on.
Jordan also was able to transcend some of the frictional aspects between established NBA culture and, as you say, as the NBA got modern and more stylized. The couple examples that come to mind would be length of shorts, when they had the length of shorts police out there and they're actually measuring them because David Stern was concerned. I had a conversation with David Stern on these airwaves, in fact, after the controversial decision to airbrush Allen Iverson's tattoos off of his body for the cover of Hoop magazine. Then there was Jerry Krause at one point talking about the cornrow hairstyle. And there was a there was a belief that that was something that was just an image that they didn't want. And it's just more chapters that the NBA has always had in this push and pull with a discomfort with that aspect of the culture. And in large part, it's one of these things that it never really happened with Jordan in any specific way. Is it because he was great? Is it because he was somehow figured out a way to be anodyne in that regard? But he knew where to position himself, so that wasn't ever really an issue.
Well, as I'm saying, a lot of that has to do with age. You know, Jordan is the guy who's associated with the longer shorts, but it's the Fab Five in cultural memory who's associated with sort of fully adopting that style. Jordan's the first guy to wear long shorts, but when the Fab Five wore them, they were longer and even bigger. They sort of reflected this hip-hop style. You know, the cornrows, those things had been popular back in the 70s. They became popular again around Iverson in the late 90s. Again, as I'm saying, Michael was older and then having moved on. You know, all of those issues that came up with basketball and hip-hop, late 90s, early 2000s, the NBA was playing hip-hop music throughout the arenas. Hip-hop had a very prominent place, but there was controversy around hip-hop style, you know, and of course, ultimately, in the mid-2000s, you get the dress code. A lot of that is Michael's era, you know, his age, the time that he came around, and how those cultural changes happened. And Michael was so far above even the league at a certain point in terms of his image. He was a global icon, and so a lot of things that may have applied to people younger than him just didn't really apply to him because he was seen as a superstar on such a massive level that he had his own lane and everybody else was dealing with those style controversies that came about because of hip-hop.
We're talking with author and professor Dr. Todd Boyd here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Something, an image from this documentary that stands out to me, and it's something when we had Bill Cartwright on the other day, we talked to him about it, that really I just, my jaw drops. When, here's Patrick Ewing now. Patrick Ewing is talking and very honestly and openly about Jordan, you know, being snatching his soul, you know, stealing away his dreams for so many years in so many heartbreaking ways. And what is Patrick Ewing wearing? He's wearing the Jumpman logo on his shoulder. We think of the term end, and we have abstracted the term. But when you think about being branded, Jordan put it on him right there. And you talk about owning somebody. He's branded him there. And I just, it was incredible to me to think about that. What's the significance of that logo? Even if it's not necessarily having to do directly with Jordan himself, what is the meaning of it? What may be the lasting meaning of that particular logo?
Well, I mean, think about how many people in history have had their own logo. You know, not very many. The logo, the Jumpman logo, I think just embodies everything that Michael Jordan meant to the culture. You know, it starts with the sneakers, and of course we have a whole sneaker culture now that grew up around, you know, Air Jordans, a huge sneaker culture. The Jumpman logo embodies the fact that, you know, as a basketball player, Michael was incredible, but he transcended the basketball court. He became an icon across the globe, you know, endorsing numerous products. I mean, a Jumpman is Nike and then brand Jordan. But it just embodies the fact that, you know, he became this superstar who went beyond his sport and became recognizable just across the world. And that cultural legacy is part of his overall legacy. We're not just talking about him as a basketball player. We're talking about him as a basketball player and a cultural icon. And there's only a really, really small handful of athletes in American history who could claim both of those mantles, athlete and icon. So he's in a really, really small group, and I think that Jumpman logo just kind of embodies all that he represented culturally, as well as, of course, speaking to where it started, which was on the basketball court.
Last question for you, Dr. Boyd. One of the running themes in this has been Michael Jordan's single-minded ruthlessness. And it can be thought of in, there's no right or wrong answer. It can be a remarkable and impressive desire to win. And we've talked to people who say they want to watch with their kids to show their kids, this is what it takes. This is dedication. This is intense professionalism. And it also has been depicted as kind of a pathology, is what's wrong with this guy? And who's like this? And is, you know, inventing some of these windmills at which to tilt, you know, is this okay? So I guess the question for you is this image of his, of this almost this human insatiable competition shark. The rings are there, the trophies are there, and the ends might have justified the means, but is it positive or negative for sports culture or for popular culture that this is who he is and was?
I would say it's American. That's what I would say. I wouldn't characterize it as positive or negative. It's American. I think what Michael represented was especially American desire to win at all costs, to dominate. You know, you said at the ends, justify the means. It's interesting, and I think a lot of people would like to think, oh, you know, he lifted weights and he got better after the Pistons kept beating him, and he just, you know, was relentless in pursuing his goal. And, you know, maybe that is true partially, but I think what people are seeing now is, you know, Michael was not a nice guy. I think it's kind of interesting. A lot of people have been going after Isaiah Thomas, but, you know, why is it okay to berate and humiliate and abuse people in one instance and it just be considered the drive to win? And in another case, Isaiah is considered the worst person in the world because he walked off the floor and wouldn't shake Michael's hand. That's a bit hypocritical. I think what you see in both cases, Isaiah, of course, native of Chicago, Michael, you know, they wanted to win, and winning is sometimes not pretty. And maybe the public doesn't recognize that this is what it takes to win an NBA title. It becomes an almost maniacal focus. There's a lot of, you know, things that transpire that are not positive, that are not life-affirming, that are kind of dark and negative and just problematic from a human standpoint. So I think the lesson is, you know, when you talk about this pursuit, this is an American pursuit. A lot of people are very comfortable saying that, you know, the ends justify the means. If this is what you have to do to win, then so be it. I mean, Michael's a product of his environment, as we all are. And so when I look at it, I don't think of it necessarily as positive or negative. I think of it as this is the American way. And for that moment in time, Michael Jordan represented it in ways that were not always nice and neat and clean and polite, but were the opposite of all that. And so, you know, a lot of people will look at that and say, you know, I want to win, and they'll excuse, you know, certain bad behaviors in the pursuit of it. And maybe other people will look at it and say, you know, I want to win and hopefully try to be a better person about it. Is that possible? One does not know, but I think it's an interesting lesson in one's method and one's approach. And whether or not if you win at the end, it kind of erases all of the negativity that may have led up to it.
I hadn't thought of The Last Dance as a mirror being held up to all of us, but indeed that's what you described. This is fascinating stuff, Dr. Boyd, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
That is Dr. Todd Boyd, and I could do another three segments on this, believe me. But man, we got to make room for Len Casper because we got stuff to talk about with him. He is coming your way. We're going to check in with our friend Len, who's been actually really busy doing a whole bunch of stuff. He's got a lot going on in all this time. So he's going to come say hi next on The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
Here it comes. Drive to left. Grand slam time.
Len Casper.
That's win.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, baby.
TV voice of the Cubs.
Hey, one other question about Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Does he still qualify for the Wookiee of the Year?
Slightly above average bassist.
Slap at the bass.
Len Casper.
Cubs win!
On The Score.
Len Casper is on Twitter, at Len Casper. He is with us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. And it seems counterintuitive, but just as sports shut down, it's almost like you got busier. How does that happen?
It's a good question. I want to apologize for missing my my call time last week, but we've stayed very busy. Marquee Sports Network doing a nightly half-hour show, Cubs 360, and I'm usually on that a couple of times a week. JD and I have a new podcast that is the official Cubs podcast. And by the way, Bob Odenkirk will join us this week, and that should be out early tomorrow. And I'm a big podcast guy, so to be able to host one is really cool. And then, you know, I've been getting calls from a lot of friends around the league and typically do one or two podcasts or Zoom calls. I'm just trying to say yes to everything right now because, as you know, Dan, I don't have a lot going on, and so it gives me something to look forward to that's somewhat at least tangentially related to my day job.
And on the music side, there is the Spotify playlist. Was it Len's Deep Cuts? What was that?
Yeah, the Cubs asked a bunch of people for 10 songs of your choice, and I decided to go the new wave post-punk route because that's kind of what I'm into right now, and tried to pick a bunch of tunes that maybe most people hadn't heard before, and hopefully a few people liked a couple of the songs I put on there.
We were talking earlier, but during the Midday Midway, I don't know if you heard the story, that the guitar used by Kurt Cobain for the 1993 MTV Unplugged set is going to be up for auction. And I had no idea how rare a guitar it was and how he had customized it and put the pickups in there and these special switches. And it even comes in its original case that's got baggage claim tags on it and all sorts of stuff. And they're thinking they're going to get $1 million for this, a minimum of $1 million.
Wow. Well, I would say that particular performance is one of the iconic live performances of all time. And just off the top of my head, I think of Cheap Trick live at Budokan, right? I think of Frampton Comes Alive. And then I would put that Nirvana Unplugged special right in the top three. So, yeah, I think it should garner that much money. And, you know, they're unfortunate. Unfortunately, their career was short-lived due to the tragic death of Cobain. But, man, if I had the money, I'd definitely be in on that.
Is there any band, you mentioned that you were into post-punk new wave lately, has this particular environment, and I've heard this from some people just anecdotally, because we sometimes were receptive to art in a way that is beyond our control, that we may just say, you know, oh, I don't like that. And then you find yourself gravitating to something and you don't know exactly why, you just kind of are. Has that happened to you in the last 2 months or so as this has gone on? Have your tastes changed to appreciate something in a new or different way?
That's a really good question. Probably not. I do think the post-punk new wave, and when I say that, I'm kind of referring to a lot of the Britpop from the 80s, you know, Psychedelic Furs, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Cure, that kind of stuff. And kind of on the surface, there's some darkness and sounds very moody, but there's something also inspiring and uplifting about stuff that puts you in a familiar place, I guess. And so I think sometimes when you embrace that and it's a little bit of the anxiety, it makes your own anxiety dissipate a little bit. And I'm vacillating on two things here. One is remembering how fortunate I am, and knock on wood, that my family's been healthy and we're okay in all the right ways, while also feeling a little lost because, quite honestly, part of my identity is being at the ballpark every day and calling games and being around a lot of people, and to have that taken away has been really difficult. And so it's that balance of, you know, I feel good and I feel bad about, you know, 10 different times each day, and it kind of affects how I feel about whether we're going to play or not. But depending on the time of day you ask me, it's like, oh yeah, we're absolutely going to have a season, or I don't see how there's any chance of it. And that happens on a daily basis.
So how do you then consciously balance your, and like we all do, your desire to get back to baseball and to have baseball, to almost like possess it as a fan, with the larger responsibility to just making sure that some player who, or players that might be in a more specifically medically adverse situation, either individually or with their families, doesn't feel pressured to get back to something he doesn't want to do?
Well, I think the big takeaway for me over the last week or so, and I wasn't quite sure because I don't talk to players on a daily basis. You know, I'm able to stay in touch with guys, but I've really given them their space. And I've talked to more front office people over the course of this shutdown. But I'm really not necessarily shocked, but a little surprised at how conscious the players seem to be of the health risks involved. There is not a sense of overwhelming, absolutely, let's play, just give me the time, give me the day, and we're good. And I think they're being very thoughtful about it. And so, you know, as they say, there's when there's the will, there's the way. The will is there on every side of it. For me, it's more about the players understanding that there is some risk here. And if we do get back to business, they're going to go in knowing that we're going to have to take all the precautions in the world. And it's going to change fundamentally, I guess, how we go about our business, which will be very interesting to watch.
Len, thanks for the time. As always, glad you said yes to us as well. Continued good health to you and yours.
Always yes to you guys, and same to you. Thanks, Dan.
That's Len Casper on our list of guests today. We also talked to Mike Florio, to Evan Drellich, and to the fascinating Dr. Todd Boyd. I want to go actually back and re-listen to some of that stuff just to make sure I heard all this. Really good. Thanks to Jay Zawoski for being our executive producer. He's the one that thought to put Dr. Boyd on, actually. That's great. Thanks to Kevin Zipak for all of his hard work as well. Shane Reardon, Mitch Rosen, everybody else. Kevin Zipak, who helps out at the Score Studios. Thanks for listening. And keep washing your hands. Keep making sure you are wearing your mask over your nose when you are indoors. Get outside. Exercise. Stay healthy. Be smart. Be nice. Listen to doctors, and only listen to people who listen to doctors. Lawrence Holmes is coming up next. We'll be back with our Thursday show tomorrow. Ian Happ is going to join us. So we'll mess with him, talk about how he and the guys back at the compound are feeling. Looking forward to that. Have a great rest of your day.
Listen to Lawrence Holmes weekdays noon to two on The Score.
Bill Melton.
Herm Schneider is the one that really told me. She said, Bill, Michael Jordan is going to be coming in here and put him in a position, you know, set up in the box. And then I saw him live batting practice. Told MJ, I said, you understand, I'm from California, so I'm a Lakers fan. Well, that set everything off where we had a lot of fun. Say this thing about MJ. Every day there, he's punctual. He was there, ready to go, and really wanted to do this.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to two on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com on radio.com. Sports Station.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.